and gentlemen, friends and open-minded people, wherever you live across the United States of America, Europe, and the world, this is David Duke, and this is truly Human Rights Radio. Real human rights. Not what's being produced in this world by the Jewish, what they call, masters of the universe, as Senator Coleman described these Jews, who are now reaching out to control the last vestiges of social media, like TikTok. Paramount is big, but they already controlled it. They just have different ones now. They got Barry Weiss, who's going to be in charge of CBS. Of course, not that CBS News and CBS and CNN weren't controlled by Jews for years. Yes, they have been. And they just want tighter control. Before they even took over this, before they started taking over TikTok, they took it over in the sense of a Jewish IDF officer. And that's not really the IDF. It's not the Israeli Defense Force. It's the Jewish terrorist force. It's the JTF. But you don't know this, and you don't understand, and you don't understand and realize that the Jewish military and the Jewish Mossad was actually created from organizations of the entire world, the entirety of Europe, even America, classified as terrorist organizations, the Irgun and these other Jewish organizations that blew up the King David Hotel, that assassinated Count Bernadette. And that was the UN person that was supposed to oversee this thing. And the United Nations was supposed to have this, basically a two-state solution. But for some reason, the Palestinians never got their state. They haven't got their state for 70 years. Everybody in the USA said they got to have their state. All the settlements in the West Bank, all the Jewish settlements in Gaza were all opposed, not by every member of the Security Council, including the United States. The United States signed off on resolutions demanding that Israel vacate these other people's lands, other people's businesses, other people's farms, the Palestinians. And again, this was all designated by the original UN agreement, sponsored by Britain and others from the Balfour Declaration, to be part of the Palestinian primary area. Also, from the very beginning, under international law, the Jews who were in their areas were not allowed by law, by custom, by any sort of human rights standard, to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, kick them out of their own houses, steal their houses from them. It gave them to have this area under their control, but it did not give them the right to murder people, to terrorize people. In fact, they used a whole system of terrorism to terrorize, specifically terrorize the Palestinians and drive them out of their homes, their farms, their businesses, their communities. And they did it by massacres such as Deir Yassin, which ironically, or maybe appropriately, is right across the valley. It's in sight, actually, Deir Yassin, where they raped and murdered more than 100 Palestinian women, children, elderly. We know the French doctor who witnessed what happened here, talked about how these Jewish soldiers put their bayonets into the bellies of Palestinian pregnant women. And then Menachem Begin and others publicized this massacre. They went around on sound trucks saying that, you know, they talked about the massacre, Deir Yassin, to scare the Palestinians and get them to try to survive with their families and run away from these Jewish troops. When they ran away, they were never allowed to return. Israel was founded on terrorism. The King David Hotel was against the British because the British were saying, okay, we're giving you this Balfour Declaration. In fact, the Balfour Declaration was not actually written by Balfour. It was under his name as the guy that was in charge of foreign conditions, foreign policy, the ministry. But the guy that actually wrote it was a guy named Armory, and organizations and websites such as major websites of Jews, for instance, called one of the biggest ones is My Jewish Learning. I got a big headline, The Secret Jew, who's actually the writer of the Balfour Declaration. But it was all a bait and switch. Oh, we're gonna have a Balfour Declaration that says they must absolutely enforce and keep and protect the human rights of the indigenous people in those regions. They have no right to steal their land. They had no right to kill them. They had no right to murder them. They had no right to imprison them. They had no right to do that. But they weren't planning that. They were planning a greater Israel from day one. It's just kind of like a used car salesman that gets an ad for this beautiful car that's, you know, like, get this Chevrolet, and it's, you know, it's a $7,000 book value, and right now you can get it for $3,000. And then you run down to get it, and they say, oh, that's sold. But we've got over this car over here, and this is a good deal, too. And of course, it isn't the same deal. That's exactly how they operate. They know how to do this stuff. They lie, just like this so-called peace agreement, this ceasefire agreement. Israel's already violating it up and down the map. Now they're saying that they can't locate, you know, they're saying that they're going to hold all aid, food, and these Palestinians are starving to death. They don't even have clean water. Because, of course, the Jews of Israel blew up the water treatment and blew up the sewage systems, too, so they have bad water and diseases and so forth flowing, as well as keeping the Palestinians from having antibiotics. They blew up the hospitals with lies about how there were Hamas in the basements of these places, which is a giant lie. Funny thing is, there was a very interesting thing on Jewish television in Israel showing how there was a massive underground, just in the tunnels of Israel, under this major apartment complex of these Jewish intelligence agents and everything and their operations in the underground. And of course, the real truth is that the true agents of terrorism and murder, it is a giant lie to say that Hamas is a terrorist organization. Maybe you could classify some things that have happened as terrorist. But if it is true that Hamas is a terrorist organization, which tried, in fact, most Israelis are part of the terrorist organization called the IDF. Again, it should be called the JTF. It should be called that. But it's not. And the interesting thing is, the best barometer you can use to show a terrorist organization is the vast and disproportionate murder of non-combatants. It's one thing to blow up or attack military installations. It's another thing to kill women and children. And Benjamin Netanyahu, literally after October 7, got up and said that Palestinians are Amalekites. Of course, there's no evidence that they have any relation to the Amalekite people. And even what's written about in Samuel says that the Amalekites dared to resist the Jewish invasion of their areas 400 years earlier. So we have to have a command by God to kill them all, man, woman, child, even suckling baby. Make sure they get them all. And every Israeli knows this. And so what Netanyahu was doing was evoking Amalek and the history of Jews hating Amalek and saying the Palestinians were Amalekites, saying these people are monsters. But how many children on October 7th, supposed to be the greatest thing since, worst thing since the Holocaust, did these Palestinians kill? How many children did they kill? That's anybody under 18. And by the way, you can join the Israeli military at 17 or 18. But how many Israeli children were killed on October 7th? Now, the first few days, we had massive propaganda, saturation about that these Palestinians were beheading Jewish kids and putting Jewish babies in ovens and so forth. The actual number of babies that died on October 7 were 2. And there's no evidence that Palestinians targeted babies. There is a lot of evidence that huge numbers of Jews died because of the Hannibal Directive in Israel. If you look at what one of the things the Palestinians wanted to do was get some prisoners of war to exchange for the thousands of prisoners that Israel had taken and held. Before the war even started, Israel held 6,000-7,000 at least Palestinians prisoners in their jails, most without even any charges, official charges. And in those prisons, they were tortured. And we found that out because of a few Jewish whistleblowers. And we found that out. There's a great article in The Intercept about it where they showed this huge basement, by the way, this dungeon. And they show about 30 or so Palestinians on the floor. And some of them are big and tall, like adults, and some of them are the size of children. And all of them in this room, on the floor. They're all stripped naked from the waist down. And most of them have their legs apart for some reason. And we know that there was a prosecution in Israel, or attempted, of some of these Israeli guards, 11 of them, or 10 or 11 guards, gang raping a man, a Palestinian. Put him in the hospital. Palestinian man. And God help the women, too, because things like Save the Children have documented 30-40% of Palestinian kids are molested. First thing happens is these men are controlling them in these prisons, not women. First thing they do to these little girls, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, first thing they do is strip them down naked. And they're subject to terrible abuse. And by holding these children and others, what they can do also is threaten the parents. Because the parents definitely cannot protest, especially if they're speakers or they're writers, poets, journalists, whatever. They can't write or speak or do anything to resist this evil of Israel without making sure that their daughters or their children or others are raped, even men. They even raped one of the heads of the main hospital in Gaza. This is true. It's unbelievable. Now, as far as rape goes, we have Ynet News, which is a major Jewish publication, that was writing just a few years ago of the appointment, and he's there serving it. His name is Karim. He's the top Judaism rabbi of the Israeli army. And by the way, it's not an Israeli army. It's a Jewish army with a Jewish rabbi. A Jewish rabbi who is representative of the Jewish faith or the Jewish religion, which is supposed to teach them morality. And the headline in Ynet News is, new top rabbi of the Israeli IDF says that it's permissible for Jewish soldiers to rape Palestinian or Gentile women. That's what it says. It's permissible. In actual fact, that headline was a not full disclosure of what he actually said. And in his actual statement, he literally said, not only was it permissible, it was a good thing. It was a moral thing. In fact, the words they use to describe these actions as a good thing for Jews is horrific in its own self. In this article, it quotes him directly from his own blog. And this is his own blog. This is not some sort of interview or some sort of conversation that's recorded and exposed. This was his own blog, his own carefully written statements, and certainly edited statements, whatever. It's his own statements. And he said, not only is it, you know, permissible, he said, when an Israeli soldier, a Jewish soldier, gives in to the evil inclination to rape a Gentile woman of his enemy, the woman, you know, just women, Gentile women, to give in to his evil inclination to rape a woman. He literally says, he goes on to say, it's actually a good thing. It's a good thing. In fact, he says, and even funny, he says, not funny, but it's disgusting, but he says, is it okay? I mean, when a Jew gives in to the evil inclination to rape an attractive Gentile woman, which, by the way, all Gentiles, we're in the same boat as Palestinians. They're coming for Palestinians today, but they've come for a lot of Europeans too. Just take a look at the Bolshevik Revolution. We'll be talking about that today on this great Friday of exposing these issues. And he says, it's really a good thing because these Jews need rest and relaxation. And you notice I'm calling them Jews. I'm not calling them Israelis. The reason why they're called Israelis, they're not called Israelis in Israel, they're called Jews. Israel is being demanded by the Jews to call it a Jewish state, and we have to be dedicated to Israel as a Jewish state. But we don't call them Jews for some reason. When we talk about Israeli atrocities, we don't talk about Jewish atrocities. When we talk about Russian atrocities, we talk about Russians. If we don't talk about the Russian Federation, we talk about Russian atrocities. When we talk about French doing something, say in Africa or something, it's French atrocities. But we don't talk about Jewish atrocities. Why? That's just bad optics, huh? It's bad propaganda. So he says, it's great. They need this rest and relaxation. It helps them recover. And it helps them go out and kill more innocent Palestinian civilians and children. He really says that. In the Talmud, it says more horrific things than that. When a Jew rapes a little girl, that girl, the little girl he's raping, this is in the Talmud, must die. Because of that little girl, this little baby who tempted the Jew, he caused the Jew to sin. So she must die, not him. The Talmud is full of things like that, which are so shocking. But we're not allowed to talk about it. Now, they keep saying it's all just a matter of discussion and so forth, but it really isn't. If you want to read about that, you can get this online, the Jewish Encyclopedia from 1906, which is like one of the biggest compendiums of Jewish thought, including Talmudic thought, Torah, and many other aspects in it. And it really gives you the true scope of what the Torah is, what the Talmud is. And it has a lot of amazing quotes talking about, for instance, how Jews are men are human beings, but Gentiles, and they're the chosen, and Gentiles are not human beings. Only Jews are men. That's the way they used to call mankind. I guess that's misogynistic because it doesn't say man, you know, it's mankind, not man and womankind, but anyway, they say that it's only Jews are men. Rabbi Schneerson, and this is what's so amazing, and this is fact and truth that nobody can deny, that it's easy to look up and check these things. Donald Trump, President of the United States, along with his daughter and her husband, the vicious and vile and criminal family, Jared Kushner, and his whole family are criminal, which Trump pardoned, by the way, he's in the White House. And they've gone to visit the tomb of Rabbi Schneerson. Rabbi Schneerson, who was one of the Chabad Lubavitch rabbis, with a lot of these radicals. And Chabad Lubavitch has, you know, the Jews are only 17 million people. There are at least a million of them in the world, and they have lots of money, lots of power. And they have very close connections to the Jewish religion in Israel, and which is part of the state religion of Israel. And guess what? He wrote a book called Conversations. Very, you know, a very well-read and well-circulated book in Israel called Conversations, in which he says that the difference between Jews and Gentiles, by the way, you're a Gentile, they're Jews, and Jews are 1/5 of 1% of the population of planet Earth, and Gentiles are 99.8% of the population. Gentiles encompass all the diversity of the world. There is simply Jews on one hand, which are the chosen people, and Gentiles, who are 99.8% of the population of the earth, and they're others, you know, and they're actually, according to Rabbi Schneerson, which, by the way, was given a gold medal or whatever from the United States Congress, when he's actually telling all these Gentile congressmen, this is what he says in Conversations, that the difference between Jews, a Jew and a Gentile, is greater than the difference between a Jew and any animal, or a monkey, a pig, anything else. I mean, the difference between a Jew and a Gentile is on the species level. It's not just the racial level. And I do think that they consider themselves a race. Netanyahu always uses the term. Many other Jewish publications, the Forward, which is kind of a liberal Jewish publication, has a big article, Jews are a race, and because a race basically is defined as a people of very close genetic ancestry of certain traits that are common. They have haplotypes and different aspects of their genetic heritage and certain genetic markers which can distinguish them, and any genetic test like Ancestry.com or anything like that can show Jewish ancestry. And it does exist. And anybody who says they don't allow an ancestry test or a DNA test in Israel is not telling the truth. They do allow them in Israel. And even what they call Birthright Israel literally was talking about how they want to have genetic testing sometimes to make sure that these people are Jews. Because it's all about getting Jews to go to Israel and marry Jews, hopefully settle in Jews, Birthright Israel. And by the way, you can read a story in the New York Times talking about Erfurt, Germany, and talking about the rise of the so-called Ashkenazi Jews, who basically were Jews, Sephardic Jews, who went to northern Germany, Erfurt. They had some intermarriage, but they also had a massive birth rate among Jews that were other Jews from different parts of Europe that intermarried with them. But they talk about how the diversity in the Jewish cemetery there, and when they examine their DNA and the remains of the Jews in Erfurt Cemetery, first of all, they were similar. They did have some similarities and some genetic commonality with Jewish graves in Judea. So, again, that doesn't, by the way, give, and if you say that that would give Jews the right to come steal the land of Palestinians, you're insane. Do anywhere that the Romans owned in the old world, because Jews controlled some of this land for even 200, 300, 400, 500 years at the most, and not all of the land, because they controlled that, 2,000 years later or so, they can come in and steal the land from people? If that were true, the world would be a pretty crazy place, wouldn't it? It's just ridiculous. That does not give them the right to do anything. But the point of the article was, in the New York Times, you could look it up, just look up Erfurt, Germany, look up Jewish geneticists such as Osterer, O-S-T-R-E-R, I think. And he's one of the top Jewish geneticists. And the article in the New York Times points out that in about 800 or 900 Common Era, A.D., what we used to say, before the Jews told us we shouldn't have any reference to Christ, but That's what it was. So before the Common Era, CE, or in the Common Era in 900, and when 800, when the Ashkenazis had a population explosion, just an explosion. They had kids hand over fist. And by the way, they had huge rituals and laws which kept them separate. There was some mixing in the beginning, and there was a little bit of mixing which caused Ashkenazi Jews to have more people there than the Sephardic in terms of the blondes or European-looking, more light-skinned, light-eyed people, but not most of their people, but anyway, certainly a sector of them. But then they had this intense Jewish inbreeding and this population explosion, and they moved to the East. That's the real genetic truth about all these things. To the point, and it points out in this article, in fact, part of the subtitle is that there is absolutely less diversity in the Jewish people today than there was then, because Jewish inbreeding, for someone to convert to Judaism, for instance, was extremely difficult, especially obviously for a man. When you're a full-grown adult male and you've already gone through puberty and you have very large organs of reproduction in your body, I won't go into all the details, and you do a circumcision there, and you do it by a Jewish molehill, which does all these things which are kind of unspeakable, which any Gentile would hate, you're not going to get many takers of a circumcision, especially in the old days, without an anesthetic and without antibiotics, and where they do certain things orally, which is unbelievable. And many people would die from it, especially when you're an adult. You would die from these things, or you could lose your family jewels from these things. This was a huge barrier to intermarriage, and that's why they demanded circumcision, and Orthodoxy in Judaism still does, and most of Reform too. They demand that you be circumcised, even though that is a barrier to intermarriage. Now, when a Jew wanted to marry a Gentile woman, a man, or a woman, a man, they were considered dead by their parents. The old saying, they covered their mirrors. They did a whole shabbos. They did a whole deal where they considered their children dead. And they were divorced from the Jewish community. They were alone. And and because the Jewish community, one thing it did do is support each other, just like a criminal gang will support each other. It wasn't just benevolent, let me tell you. And in those ghettos and in those areas, they kept them separate from the Gentiles, and they kept a lot of secrets there. And by the way, when they connected and created Israel, the Jews had a lot of power in the world. The Rothschilds were some of the biggest bankers in the world. When Israel was created in the early Zionist movement, they were already some of the biggest banksters. Even in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you had Goldman Sachs, you had Lehman Brothers, you had Cunningham Loeb Company, some of the biggest Wall Street bankers. The organization of the Federal Reserve Bank was actually begun by a few individuals, a few bankers, and the leading one, the guy that was the orchestrator of this thing, was Warburg. Warburg, a Jewish banker connected with the Rothschild family. Yes, it's all true. And you have massive Jewish organizations today that are criminal. Now let's move on to the next part of the agenda. And this is the agenda of, what's going on today? What's going on right now? So let's first of all take on a subject which is extremely sensitive, but extremely important. So one thing I pointed out through Jewish documentation, Jewish leaders, major Jewish magazines, major Jewish figures, like, for instance, Rabbi Yosef and his son, who was the chief Sephardic rabbi. And when he died, by the way, he had the biggest funeral in the history of Israel. I mean, it was amazing. Millions of Jews. Biggest funeral ever. Honored. What did Rabbi Yosef preach about Palestinians? He preached that they were dogs and animals. What did he preach about Gentiles? Well, one of his famous sermons, and you can read about this in the Jerusalem Post, one of the leading papers in Israel. One of the main things he taught were, and this was exactly what he preached on television, live television, to the whole nation of Israel, the leading rabbi. He's the guy who was head of the Chas party. He was the guy that was making the decisions about who's accepted as a Jew in immigration in Israel, which is very tight in terms of the racial aspect of it, the ethnic aspect of it, and on all the other rules, which, by the way, has led to Israel having the highest birth rate in the entire quote-unquote Western world. These are the same Jews, though, that pushed birth control and pushed abortion in the West. Israel is not considered an abortion-friendly country because Jews, if a Jewish woman wants to get an abortion, they don't worry about the Palestinians so much if they want to get an abortion. That's okay with them. But when a Jewish girl does, they have to go before some committee in the hospital. They're going to grill her. Why do you want an abortion? And you shouldn't have an abortion and all this stuff. And they have the highest birth rate, over 3, by the way, in the Western world. Isn't that something? Isn't that? And I can show you articles by Jews in America and in Europe literally boasting how Jews are the biggest leaders of abortion. Wow. Isn't that interesting? They promote one thing for us and something else. So there's been a big controversy about, of course, and there should be, of the assassination. And yes, it's an assassination. It's a political and probably a state assassination, just like I believe the assassination of John F. Kennedy was, just as the assassination of Israel in Qatar against Hamas affiliates, Hamas people, allegedly. I don't think they got many of those, but they did it against an American ally, and Netanyahu said he'll go anywhere in the world. Israel is so famous for assassinations outside of Israel, all over the world. They brag about killing people all over the world and kidnapping people. They about violating the sovereignty of so many countries. They brag about that. And so the question is, who killed Charlie Kirk? Now, the whole case on this Tyler kid is falling apart because there's so many inconsistencies, so many things that don't make any sense. This high-charged bullet, 30-odd six or whatever, from this old single-shot gun. Now, the whole thing is falling apart. But when you do an assassination like that, you create a scenario, or you try to create a posse, or you do other things to make the blame fall on someone else. That's standard procedure. Remember, though, an intelligence organization is a secret organization, and it's hard to get to the truth to prove that they did some sort of political assassination in another country, because their people are located in Israel. So they can come in to another country, and then they can go back to their country, and we can't touch them. We can't touch them. We can't look at any documentation. And anybody in that country that would betray their secrets is going to be in prison and likely killed by the Mossad. Isn't that interesting? Now, there's a way that when we talk about state assassinations, and by the way, there are pages and pages and pages and pages in Wikipedia, which is also an encyclopedia, so to speak, for the world. It's 1,000 times bigger than anything Britannica ever was or World Book ever was as an encyclopedia. They write about everybody, every major figure in the world, a sports figure, political figure, ideology, a scholar, whatever. And political figure is highlighted and basically given biographies in Wikipedia. Problem is, Wikipedia was founded by this Jew who is actually claims to be a Jew and says that he's totally dedicated to the Zionist cause. And he received a $1 million prize at Tel Aviv University in Israel. That's according to the Jewish Telegraph Agency. You can look it up, do some searching. And yeah, he got $1 million. And he said, of course, and I guess the guy said, well, yeah, I'm supportive of the Zionist cause, but I want to make sure that Wikipedia is fair, and Wikipedia is fair. But he allows, and everybody's in knowledge, and you can see the pictures, and you can see Jewish articles about this in Israel, where the Jewish, again, the Jewish terror organization, the force, is, you got rooms full of more than 100, 200 Israeli soldiers editing Wikipedia and controlling it. And a lot of people complain about the fact that Wikipedia is biased. Why is it biased? It's just like Google, who is basically the benefactor for Wikipedia. Without Google, Wikipedia is nothing. And Facebook and some other publications that also support it. But Wikipedia is absolutely... excuse me one second. I don't know what this is. Hello? Just one moment.
Yes. Did you try to call this number?
No, I didn't. Thanks. Okay, so anyway, sorry for the interruption. But anyway, so Wikipedia is there, and they lie. But also, they've got some truth. They Jews, interestingly enough, they want to be historical. Like, for instance, they make themselves open in a way for people that research them to be exposed. But they want to keep the record of what they do. And that's when I did, you know, major video, and I've done major work in my books documenting the Jewish role in the slave trade. How even Jacob Marcus, who was one of the leading Jewish historians in America, was commissioned by none other than the most famous encyclopedia in the world, Encyclopedia Britannica, to do a story in the history of the Jews. And in that story, he makes the simple statement in there that during the Middle Ages, that much of the commerce of Europe was controlled by Jews. They did. They controlled a lot of the trade, the guilds that controlled the trade, and they controlled lots of other commerce, as well as a lot of lending and usury and so forth that went on. But he also makes a statement that the commerce in Europe, in many ways, was dominated by Jews, especially the slave trade. Jewish writers, proud Jewish historians who were proud of their achievements, considered the fact that they dominated the slave trade, the triangular slave trade, the slave trade that brought Africans to the United States, well, became the United States and other places, the Caribbean, Mexico, the islands there, South America, and elsewhere, that these heads of the slave trade were Jews. They document, in fact, that the biggest slave trader in the colonies and in America was a Portuguese Jew, Levi, I think his name is, also a Jewish priest's name, and he was the biggest slave trader in the colonies, had owned the most ships. And they also document in their books about the slavery in South America. And they say in these books, actually, they look at the Jewish households in America. Now, slavery, only about 2% of Southern households had black slaves, about 2%. Jewish households in America, at one time, slavery was somewhat permitted in most of the colonies, Jewish households, 40% of them had slaves. Jews, actually, even though you had some plantation owners who were Jewish and some that weren't, one of the biggest ones in Florida, for instance, was a Jew, but even though they had some big plantations and so forth, the again, Jewish households, on average, And 40% of them had slaves. Yet you don't see any guilt for Jews about slavery. And that's a good example of some of the bias that we see sometimes around the movies and about the Torah and the Old Testament. Because in the Torah, it absolutely okays the Jews to enslave Gentiles and to pass the Gentiles on as slaves forever to their descendants. It kind of says that you're not supposed to enslave Jews, but you can enslave Gentiles. He definitely says you can enslave Gentiles, but also kind of says you're not supposed to, but Jews were actually doing it. In fact, in the Old Testament, it says that a Jewish man can actually sell his little girl, into slavery. Ultimately, you're talking about sexual slavery there. And it just talks about the regulation of this. And it says that, you know, it has certain rules to try, I guess, make it better for them. But it says if the master is not pleased, so that the implication is that girl's got to please her master. But if the master is not pleased, he can, you know, she can be redeemed after a while. If she does a good job pleasing him, and I guess that means everywhere, it's very implicit in all these things. If she does a good job, well, he can keep her basically, unlike the Jewish boy or the Jewish male, who can only be kept for 6 years max in indentured servitude, they can be kept forever. As long as he doesn't kick her out into destitution, or, you know, he's still got to provide for her. After all, she served as a very good sex slave. This is not an exaggeration, folks. And then you have places in there about raping, literally raping women and girls. I can give you the verses. If I have time, I'll later do that in today's show. Like, for instance, in a few places, it talks about Samaritans who Jews considered kind of mixed breed, but they actually followed the Torah, and how, and this is wild, but that Samaritans, who they really hated fully, said that Jews, you know, can, listen to that, I hate to say this, put their swords into the stomachs, the wombs of Samaritan women, pregnant Samaritan women. That's the ultimate, I guess, brutal kind of abortion. It's hard to believe these things, but it's right there. And again, that's very, very different than the teachings of Christ. And the teachings of Christ were real clear that the scribes are liars. And he says very clearly that, and this is very clearly, you can read this in the New Testament in many places. He says, God and my Father and I am about love. It's about love. God is love, literally says that. And he says that, I tell you, anybody that would hurt a child, and make them, even just to make them stumble, deserves to be dropped in the bottom of the sea. And that's four or five places in the Gospels of the New Testament. Wow. But then in the Old Testament, you have the story of the she-bears. You can look at that up. Just do an open Bible search. She-bears. And it's about how that Elijah's walking down the road to Bethel, I think it is. And he's walking down the road. And a number of little boys, and it says specifically little boys, you know, were making fun of him. Like, this is the kind of thing kids do, right? You make fun of people. Apparently he was bald and fat. And they say, hey, Baldy, what you doing up there? And all that kind of stuff. And bald head. And he got pissed off. And so he sat by the road. And he prayed to Yahweh to curse these kids. And according to these Jewish scribes that gave us this story, Yahweh sent two she-bears. Two big she-bears are giant, like grizzly-type bears. That have had kids, and they're really vile, right? And like The Revenant in that movie with DiCaprio, they talk about that. If you ever see that, it's one of the most horrific scenes you'll ever see in a movie. Anyway, so he prays to Yahweh. And Yahweh, according to them, sends two she-bears who tear apart, literally tear limb from limb. Horrific. 42 little boys. She-bears. Tear them apart. And I am, look, for me, I believe there's a lot of good things in the Old Testament. I also believe there's a lot of things that don't make any sense to me, and I don't think necessarily true, because I don't believe that the God of that Jesus is about is a God because kids are making fun of somebody. Would, you know, really, just children, that God would send she-bears to rip apart 42 little boys. I don't believe that God would say that all these children, these virgin children, for instance, of the Moabites and others, that 32,000 virgins, including little girls, would be given to the Jewish soldiers as booty. As, you know, save the virgin children for yourselves to use, you know, to your pleasure or whatever. It's unbelievable. And I believe that is a slander against God, because I believe that so much of Scripture has been copied and translated and edited. And, you know, the Bible is written and copied. And this has been for 2,000 years, or, you know, about, at least that's just at the time of Christ, 2,000 years by men. And the people who are controlling Judaism, according to Jesus Christ, are the biggest liars on the planet. And the scribes were the ones that were telling us, and they were editing this all along, what the Torah says. And of course, they were creating the foundations of the Talmud at the same time as well. And he calls them lying scribes and Pharisees. And Jesus Christ, his entire ministry was about calling out the corruption, the literal evil that existed in the Jewish establishment, the same evil in the Jewish establishment which crucified Jesus Christ and killed so many Christians, which is all recorded in the New Testament. And if I'm critical about some of these things, understand when I'm writing and reading the Old Testament, how many times did God punish the Israelites? Repeatedly. It's really odd. You start reading it. I've read the Old Testament thoroughly a couple of times. I've also looked up the passages that are relevant to all these things and sorted them all out. And it's a shocking thing. I mean, constantly. So they go there and they're worshiping other gods, they're violating the commandments of God, they're violating the laws of God, and, you know, and then God punishes them. And then it seems like the next day or whatever, they do the same thing again, again, and again, and again, until finally, of course, they crucify the Son of God. And by the way, and Christ says that, boy, time goes by so fast in these shows. I can't believe I'm out of time. I had so much to say. But I'll have to just save it for next week. But, yeah. We got to understand something, folks. What's going on. I'm gonna close by something that I've got to quote and quote it very fast, very quickly. So this guy Hammer, who is, by the way, one of these Jews of Turning Point, just to show you how much they hate Europeans and European Christians, because Europeans, of course, were the ones that really adopted Christianity, the Gentiles. And this is what he says in his post. This is Josh Hammer, It's been exposed with by a number of people. And this is exactly what he says, quote, Jew hatred is inherent in the European DNA. You got it? Another place, he says something very similar, just in different words. He says, quote, he says, I'm Jewish. Proudly, I advocate every single day of my life for the Jewish people and for the Jewish state of Israel. It's not America. Now, if he says it's inherently in the Gentile DNA and the European DNA, that's got to be a blood libel, right? That's more of a blood libel than anything that's been said about Jews. It's in Gentile. Also, I quoted many times Michael Aitman's article in the Times of Israel. He's the head of the Kabbalah Institute. And he say all Gentiles are anti-Semites in their DNA. It's a fact of nature. In other words, they're all murderers. They're all killers. They're all Nazis. We have to stand up to this. That's the ultimate racism that truly exists in this world, and it's a danger to all of us. He's one of the leaders of Turning Point and supposed to be a friend of Charlie Kirk, but he can't really be a friend of Charlie Kirk because he realizes that it's in the DNA of Gentiles, and especially Christians like Charlie Kirk, that they're a threat because they have anti-Semitism in their DNA. It's like what he's saying here. That's truly a blood libel in every sense. It's a vile blood libel because, of course, anti-Semitism is presented as the most evil thing possible for anyone in the world. Yet anti-Semitism, by their definition, is simply people that oppose the genocide of what's going on against the Palestinians in Israel. And the Jewish power structure that's led to all these wars, like the Iraq War, which is a war for Israel, that American boys and America played for in blood and a huge fortune. Literally $8 trillion, I said $1 trillion, by a study from none other than Brown University of major academics. $8 trillion, excuse me. That's the reality. This is for the rinse repeat broadcasts, which have a time frame. And I'm going to do an addendum for you for the archive. So if you want to go to the archive at hrradio.net, and you can hear this addendum, special addendum on some of these issues. It's going to be amazing. So get this and enjoy. So I want to go for a while into the aspects of why I believe and why I think the evidence is overwhelming. It's hard to prove these things with a smoking gun when you have an intelligence agency worth billions of dollars and is protected in Israel doing an assassination, even though we know that there's no state in the world that assassinates more than Jews, even though it's a small sliver of a state. But it's very fascinating when you look at the depth of their violation of international sovereignty and laws. First off, as the authenticated posts of Charlie Kirk have been proven, by the way, by the heads of Turning Point, that this is amazing because Charlie Kirk says very clearly that these Jewish donors who are taking their money out and removing their money from PPC, obviously, they're pretty angry, and they're afraid that Charlie Kirk is turning against Zionism. And he says, by the way, that these people fulfill are just absolutely true to the stereotypes we have of these chutzpah Jews. And he says that he's forced to no longer support Israel. Now, the Jewish elite and the Jewish oligarchs of Now, this country in Israel have known for weeks that Charlie Kirk was doing things absolutely opposed to Israel. For instance, he had none other than Tucker Carlson, who they consider to be an anti-Semite, speak as the keynote speaker of the last TPC event. He was making indications for years that he was going to be making a break from the Jewish elite. For instance, he said that Jewish billionaires are always complaining about facing criticism and so forth, and anti-Semitism. Yet he said Jewish billionaires have been behind the massive hate speech against European Americans and Europeans in general. But they have led it. And of course they have. This is where a lot of anti-Israel, anti-Zionist people really make a mistake. They don't understand that Jews had to replace European Americans in the levers of power of the most powerful nation on earth, the United States, and the most powerful military on earth, as well as in Europe. They needed to weaken European political power, economic power to a great degree, media power to a great degree, in order to make America from a pro-American, pro-American interest position to a pro-Israel position. And that's exactly what they did. America went from a almost 90% European-American population to a very fragmented population of less than 60%. Just like Jews were able to replace a great deal of the Palestinian, 90% of the population at the turn of the 20th century, to the point where they're almost half of that now. Tucker Carlson on his own show pointed out that European Americans went from 90% of the population and 80% of the Christian, or 80% of the American people are Christians, to the point where only 40% of the American people are white and Christian. And by the way, all true Christians know that Christian Zionism is the most anti-Christian position you could possibly hold. And by the way, it should be stated very clearly that the position of Christians in the Middle East in terms of Palestine and all those areas have been decimated. Since the earliest days of Christianity, Christians were between 40 and 50%, sometimes more, sometimes a bit less, of the population of Palestine. Now, that was maintained even after the earliest churches of Christianity have been in Palestine since the very earliest days of Christianity. Think about the fact that since the rise of Israel, Christianity has been completely decimated. Christian churches have been destroyed. Christians have been demonized and criminalized in Israel. Christians coexisted fine with people who followed Islam for 1,400 years, but have been decimated by the Zionist state of Israel. Just look at this obvious fact. It is a fact. Look at Christianity in Palestine in the beginning of the 20th century, and look at Christianity in Palestine since the creation of the state of Israel. Christianity has been devastated. Christianity's biggest enemy in the planet is Judaism and its Zionism. Speaking of Charlie Kirk, we know for a fact that he was certainly, and any Jew could recognize this because they were calling all these people anti-Semitic who he was cozying up to and what he was speaking. We saw his posts. He absolutely understood that Judaism was Antichrist and that the true Christian position was support Jesus Christ and not the Judaistic enemies of Christ. It's very difficult to prove state actors. Sometimes you have to use a lot of discovery methods that aren't usual in terms of criminal justice and criminal investigation. When states tried to determine who was an assassination committed by on cross-national terms, they use three variations that are most common in doing so. It's the acronym MMO, which stands for motive, means, and opportunity. The most important thing is motive. Who had the biggest motive? And who saw, who could see the victim of the assassination as a great threat to them, an incredible threat to them? And Charlie Kirk was a rising political star followed by millions of people. And if they would have lost Charlie Kirk to Christian Zionism or to true America First-ism, that would be the most dynamic threat of all to the Jewish control of the Republican Party and the white demographic, which is the base of their support. So, no question, they would see Charlie Kirk. And they were calling him an anti-Semite weeks before he was assassinated. As Tucker Carlson pointed out, the American Jewish Committee, the biggest Jewish organization in America, called him an anti-Semite. They said he was platforming and giving a keynote speeches to people like Tucker Carlson and supporting Candace Owens. They could not allow his voice not to be silent. Kirk was certainly more dangerous than any single certain Arab or Palestinian or anyone, Iran or Lebanon or whatever, because if the Jews lose the Republican Party, if they lose the young people of the Republican Party, if they lose control of the government of the United States, they lose Israel, and they know it. They cannot afford to risk it. They would naturally see Kirk as an existential threat to their power over the United States, and they know if they lose America, they lose Israel. So they had huge motive to silence the voice of Charlie Kirk. And they had the means. The means was they had a vast intelligence operation and spy operation in the United States and incredible aspects of that power. They successfully spied on us, even stole our enriched uranium from a major uranium supplier in America, sent it directly to Israel. This is all fact. These people have chutzpah, and they absolutely, you know, had the means to do this. Finally, they had the opportunity, and it was important for them to act fast before Charlie Kirk did more overt things. As it is, they tried to claim that he was such a good friend of theirs. That's often proof of the fact that the person lying and saying how close Charlie Kirk was or how close the suspect was to them. Like, for instance, a suspect in the killing of a wife, if the suspect says, oh yes, we had a great relationship, and he's proven to be a liar, that according to the wife, she said she was afraid of him. Charlie Kirk said to a number of his closest friends that he was terrified by Israel, that he was afraid Israel was going to kill him. Wow. That would put Israel at the top of the list. Also, when you have state assassinations, they can easily try to produce distractions, patsies. They can muddy the water and all these things to divert attention, to give a different scenario for motive. But obviously, it's never been proven the real motive this kid would have. And a lot of the so-called facts of it and the absolute deceptions that's going on by mainstream government, CIA and government agencies, FBI, which we know has been infiltrated by Jewish penetration over the decades. One of the main compilers of John F. Kennedy letters to Menachem Begin back and forth shows you the incredible angst and anger and hatred between the two parties. Kennedy wanted to stop the atomic bombs of Israel, to have them get rid of them, not have them, and Jews saw that as an existential threat. He also wanted to make AIPAC, or the Israeli lobby organizations in America, register under the foreign issue, and he demanded fairer treatment of the Palestinian people. Sandler, the academic who compiled the letters between Kennedy and Menachem, say the evidence is overwhelming that if you want to realize who assassinated Kennedy, the evidence points to the Mossad, to Israel. Forget about the mafia. Forget about anybody else. Israel is the one that had the incredible motive and felt it's an existential threat was, in fact, the Kennedy administration. Any person knowledgeable about Israel, their decadence, their evil, their murderous activities, their corruption, and their penetration of the United States of America and many of the countries of the world with their intelligence agencies would have to come to the conclusion. And when everything is put down and measured appropriately, that there's no question that Israel is the overwhelming greatest suspect, the most important suspect in the assassination of Charlie Kirk. I believe Israel killed Kennedy, and the Jewish extremists who infiltrate American politics, the American government, and control America had to destroy this man and silence him. Have a good day, folks. Go to my Gab at Real David Duke, my Odyssey at Real David Duke. And I just wish all of you the very best, and I hope you enjoy this bit of an addendum for the show. Have a great weekend, and let's just keep thinking and being free.